The Lara Murphy Show, Episode 64.
Welcome to The Lara Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Lara Murphy Show. I am one of your hosts, Bob Murphy. With me, as usual, is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how are things going?
Hi, Bob. Things are going good.
I should mention, just for those of you who haven't heard the great, fantastic, excellent news, I have my own podcast now called The Bob Murphy Show, and Carlos is featured in episode number 2, and we have a very long conversation there, but it's very interesting, I should say. So if you want to learn more about Carlos the man, not just in his role as Austrian economist and IBC expert and facilitator, go check that out. So just go to bobmurphyshow.com, and then you'll see the episodes there, and he's episode number 2. You can also just go to bobmurphyshow.com/2. It would take you right there. So just wanted to plug the podcast, but also tell people that you can learn more about Carlos's background and coming to the United States and his confrontation with the Marine Corps. It's great stuff.
I enjoyed doing that, Bob. That's an interesting twist you have to that podcast. I've actually listened to some of the other guests that you've had on there, and it is interesting.
well, I'm glad you think so.
You're able to dig into some stories and some facts that you normally don't hear about. So anyway, congratulations on that new program.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Well, we also want to just thank everybody. We've been getting lots of emails, and we do appreciate them. We read everything. I think we typically do try to answer people as much as we can, but just don't worry. Your emails definitely are being read. I don't know if you want to say anything on that topic, Carlos.
Oh, well, the same thing, Bob, that I am very appreciative of the people that take the time to write. You have great comments. You make great suggestions on the type of podcast that we should have for the future. All of that is greatly appreciated. Some of you are utilizing the phone-in, the call-in feature, and I've enjoyed talking with some of you people in person, some of the listeners, and I like it, especially when I've had several occasions where I've been speaking to husband and wife as they're wanting to know particular things about the economy and IBC in particular. So appreciate all of that, and I would say keep writing, keep calling. We enjoy communicating with our audience.
Yep, and if you're unfamiliar of how to go about that, it's at the laramurphy.com website. And again, that's LARA-murphy.com. And then the top menu there, you're going to see, I think it's on the right, a contact button. And then you just go through that menu and you can see how to either email us or set up a phone or Skype consultation if that's what you want to do. So the topic for today is just the stock market. We've been getting a lot of people emailing us and mentioning, hey, what's going on with the stock market? So why don't we just open up that can of worms and talk about that for this episode. So the backdrop here is during the month of October in particular, if you take the S&P 500 as the index, there was one period, I think if going from like October 1st to October 29th, I believe, the S&P 500 was down about 10%. It was a little bit shy of 10% on the nose. And it's come back a little bit since then, but clearly a lot of volatility. That's a huge move just for one month. And it's causing lots of normal people to be fretting about this. So as a duo who has for years been warning that the Federal Reserve has blown up a giant asset bubble, this certainly doesn't come as a shock to Carlos or me. As far as, so let me just say a few things here just to give the backdrop. Austrian business cycle theory does not tell you about market timing. It's not like, oh, this is when you want to buy these 18 stocks and then you want to sell them on this date. And did it. Obviously, Austrian business cycle theory is a much broader framework than that. It just sort of gives you an idea of the general trends in the economy. but it's certainly very useful. Okay, so I would say it's necessary but not sufficient to navigate the financial sector to know Austrian business cycle theory. And so what we've really been able to say with confidence is that the various QE programs and the Fed's policies on interest rates since the 2008 crisis blew up giant asset bubbles in real estate, in the stock market, in the treasury market that are setting us up for another crash. And then the issue is just, well, when's the crash going to occur? And so what I would say is, on that second point, for a while, the Fed was just treading water, but now they're both hiking interest rates and they are letting their balance sheet shrink. Whereas there was a period where they were hiking rates, but the balance sheet was staying constant. So again, there was a period where the Fed was holding steady. And I understand a lot of people are like, geez, you guys have been warning a long time about this stuff and it hasn't, you know, the stock market hasn't crashed yet. Well, the Fed wasn't tightening for a long time, right? They held interest rates at 0% for 7 years. And then, like I said, even when they were raising rates initially, it was not from selling off assets. They were just increasing the amount that the Fed was paying commercial banks to keep their reserves parked at the Fed, even though they weren't selling it. But now they're doing both. Now they're still raising rates in that fashion, and they are selling off assets, which sucks reserves out of the system. Another independent measure of tightness, if you will, or the fact that a crash may be looming is just a conventional measure of an inverted yield curve. And I've been talking a lot about that. If you get the LMR, I've written an article on that in the recent past. But the idea there being when the yield curve inverts, meaning short-term rates have a higher yield than long-term rates, like on treasuries, that since World War II has typically indicated that a recession's coming, depending on how you measure it and so forth. And it's not quite there yet, but it's close. And so a lot of people are saying, geez, if the Fed keeps hiking rates, they're going to invert the yield curve. Okay, so that's, again, just it's not merely a few Austrians over in the corner worrying about this. As time is progressing, more people using other types of measurements and metrics and things like that are starting to be very concerned that a crash or a recession might be coming. So how do you feel about all this, Carlos?
Well, it's almost like I'm repeating a lot of the things that we've been saying for years, Bob, that what we witnessed the Federal Reserve do shortly after the 2008 financial crisis was unprecedented. And then by pumping in so much money into the system the way they did, but in addition to continuing that quantitative easing for as long as they did and pushing down the interest rates for as long as they did, almost a full decade, it did create all kinds of economic malinvestments and weird contortions in our entire economy, to the degree that when we speak of that at a certain point, all of this is all going to come crashing down. The reason we say it is because it can't be sustained to the levels that it is. And I think the Federal Reserve knows this. And so there for a while, we were kind of saying, Bob, that the Federal Reserve has sort of painted themselves into a corner, not knowing how to get out of the hole that they created. And I think their attempt now is to try to see if they can bring down these overinflated markets gradually without panicking everybody. And I think one of the greatest assets that the Federal Reserve has added here to their whole thing is this new chair, Powell. I've been listening to his conversations, public conversations, talking about the economy and what they're doing as they've been hiking interest rates. And I see that he is just a stark contrast to Ben Bernanke and even Chairman Yellen. Powell is easygoing, easy to understand, and has a way of being calm about what's going on. Now, the other two chairs, Bernanke and Yellen, were trying to do the same thing, but for some reason, you never felt that. But when you listen to Powell speak, I can see that he does have an effect on people, and they sort of put some trust into him that what they're doing is, you know, it's all very scientific. They know exactly what they're doing. They know that they can keep doing what they're doing. It's not going to cause any major problems. And he has a way of coming across that way, which is very believable. But nevertheless, you know, we are seeing the stock market come down because it's overinflated. But it's overinflated because this is what Bernanke purposely set out to do, was to inflate those markets in particular, simply because he was trying to create that wealth effect, a feeling of we're all fine simply because we're coming out of such a crisis area, you know, time during the 2008 financial crisis, that, you know, pumping up the markets the way he did was deliberate to create a feeling of wealth. And the same thing happened with the real estate market. These two markets are very emotional, and people pay attention to them. And because of the low interest rate environment, it stimulates those two markets, and it has inflated them to such a degree that they do need to come down. But can you bring them down without creating a panic? That's where I think the Fed is right now. And it remains to be seen whether he can pull that off or not.
Well, that's interesting that you're – because, yeah, you spend more time watching these press conferences whatever than I do. So you're saying you just feel like his demeanor, he exudes a sense of calm and don't worry, we got this under control, that whereas you felt Yellen did not, or and Bernanke did not give off that sense?
Absolutely, because even after Bernanke came out of office, in some of his commentaries in the Washington Post in particular – I mean, he literally said that the whole purpose of doing QE was to create a wealth effect, and that it was going to inflate the stock market. I mean, he set out to do that. And by keeping the interest rates pushed down low, he actually was exuberant over the fact that every time the Fed would step in and to open market operations to purchase more treasuries, you know, that the markets responded accordingly. And, you know, for years now, Bob, I've watched you give presentations to audiences in which you've been able to show how the graph clearly pinpoint how every time QE was purchasing, you know, assets, that the stock market was rising right along with it. And Bernanke knew that that's what he was doing. And of course, by pushing down interest rate as low as they did, that's going to affect people that are interested in real estate, because now it says this is a good time to start construction on properties, on homes, apartment buildings, that sort of thing. And because a low interest rate is an indicator to the public that there's cheap money around. And so these two things in particular, because they're emotional markets, when they're high, it does give people a feeling that we're doing very well. I think you've heard me mention this before. You know, I've been living in this house now over 30 years, and it's gone over way over $1 million, you know, several times in that period of time. But then it'll come back down again every time we have a recession. Mm-hmm. So what I'm seeing right now is obviously the markets are reacting wildly right now to the rates continuing to go up. And Powell is on that course. He's going to keep increasing them. Obviously, mortgage rates now are going up. And so we are starting to see a slowdown in the real estate markets in various pockets throughout the United States. So it's having an effect as well with the interest rates continuing to decline. So the key again is not so much whether these markets will crash, because we've always felt, Bob, that they eventually or have to come down and will, but can it be done without panicking people? That's the main thing, because if panics people, then it drives it into another area that could be very dangerous for the whole banking sector. And that's what we would need to watch out for, that it doesn't panic people so much that it affects the banking sector. That's what I keep saying. That remains to be seen.
Yeah, so you made a lot of great points there. Let me just elaborate on some of that. So I really liked, you know, the phrase that we say, oh, the Fed's painted itself into a corner. And I have to confess, for a while there, it looked like we were just being Cassandras, because it looked like, hey, the markets have boomed and nothing bad seems to be happening. Inflation, by which people mean price inflation at the consumer level, seems to be pretty tame. And hey, you know, you guys were worrying about, now, in fairness, Carl's and I weren't running around for years talking about hyperinflation. Some other people were using that phrase a lot, but still, you know, we were saying, look at what they're doing. They're printing all this money, and then, you know, banks start lending it out. Look at the problem. And for a while, it was like the U.S. was stuck in this weird equilibrium where, as long as banks weren't lending out the money and as long as people were worried about the strength of the economy and they wanted to hold more cash balances, it was like the economy absorbed all that extra money that the Fed created in the various rounds of QE, and it looked like nothing bad was happening. Well, it does now look like finally that equilibrium is ending and we're going back to a more conventional situation. So let me just sketch out some of these issues. That if you look at standard CPI, consumer price inflation, again, these are the government's own numbers. So it's, you know, I'm not using shadow stats or something. I'm saying these are the official figures, but you don't really hear this trumpeted too much. That if you, and I will do a blog post at this at the LaraMurphy.com website. I'm going to jot a note here to remind myself to blog this if you want to see the chart and what I'm talking about. But if you look at the 12-month percentage change in the consumer price index, right? So in other words, how much higher is the CPI right now than it was 12 months ago? So that's kind of like an annual rate of consumer price inflation on a month-to-month update. That bottomed out, it was actually negative in early 2015. And that makes sense because, remember, the so-called taper happened throughout 2014. And so by the fall of 2014, that's when the Fed under Yellen stopped buying assets, right? That was the end of QE3, that the Fed had, the taper meant every month they reduced how many assets they bought until finally they just went to zero. And that happened in the fall of 2014. And that's when you saw during that year the dollar strengthened a lot against other currencies. Which, again, makes total sense that the Fed had this open-ended commitment to initially buying $85 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries, and then they start tapering it, and they go to zero, and markets like, oh, wow, they really did stop pumping in all that money. And so the dollar would strengthen once, you know, that policy certainty came in, because before that point, people thought that the Fed was going to keep inflating. Okay, so and then that showed up, I said, in consumer price indexes, that the year-over-year increase, or the 12-month percentage increase in early 2015 of the CPI, was actually negative, or, you know, roughly 0%. So in other words, in early 2015, consumer prices were about what they had been 12 months earlier. But then that line just steadily upticks until now, deep in 2018, the year-over-year increase is flirting with 3%. Okay, so again, it's been above 2% for the entire 2018. All right, so, and just to give a frame of reference, I mean, those are numbers, those are like pre-crisis numbers. In other words, the range that the CPI has been bouncing around like since late 2017 in terms of the annual increase, that's comparable to where it was, for example, in 2003, 2004. Okay, so, you know, during the housing boom years. So I'm just saying that we have left behind, as long as these trends continue, we're no longer in this weird situation after the financial crisis where, geez, no, it seems like no matter what the Fed's doing, prices aren't budging for some reason, and that seems to be going away now. We've also got wage pressures where, you know, year-over-year increases in nominal wage measures are finally rising after being very mute for a long time because people are so worried about their job security. And now, of course, the official unemployment rate is like, what, 3.7%, something like that. Now, that, to be sure, masks a lot of the problems in the labor market. And, you know, these are well known, that if people drop out of the labor force altogether, they don't count as unemployed anymore. But still, I'm just saying the Fed's conventional mandate is, oh, if unemployment's really high, then it wants to have loose policy. But if inflation gets high, by which it means CPI, then it wants to have tight policy. So right now, the official unemployment rate is very low, and the consumer price index is now you know, above normal levels, you know, because typically they say they want to have 2% inflation. Strictly speaking, that's the consumer expenditure with energy prices taken out. But still, just standard CPI has been above 2% for the entire year. So I'm just saying here that things seem like they're going back to a more normal description. And this is all occurring amidst Fed rate hikes. And so in that context, what Carlos was saying, what Powell has been telling markets is, yep, we're on schedule. We're going to keep hiking. I think that this last meeting, they said they were going to postpone it just because they were coming on the heels of such a volatile stock market. But Powell is still, he's saying the Fed's official position is we're going to continue hiking as the situation allows, because they know they're trying to reassure the world, as Carlos is saying, that, hey, this huge balance sheet that the Fed's carrying, because they're still got $4 trillion plus in assets compared to about $800 billion on the eve of the financial crisis. So the Fed is still carrying a bloated balance sheet. The banking system still has trillions in excess reserves, or over $1 trillion. So, you know, that's not sustainable. They do have to show the world that they're going to whittle that away, or otherwise the dollar would crash. And so they have to keep plowing ahead. One last thing I'll say, just to, again, show how the Fed is in a situation where it can't dawdle too much. So, again, what they've been doing is raising – is the way they've been raising interest rates is not simply by selling off assets and then that sucks reserves out of the system. What they're doing is they're increasing the interest rate that they pay to banks to keep their reserves parked at the Fed. So when they first started doing that back in October of 2008 – it was a measly 25 basis points, right? That means 0.25%. So that wasn't a big deal in the grand scheme of things. Now it's up to 2.2%. So when the, you know, when the press reports that, oh, the Fed has raised rates now to 2.2%, what that means is the Federal Reserve is paying commercial banks 2.2% annualized on the reserves that they keep parked at the Fed. And right now, the reserve balance of Federal Reserve banks is still something like $1.9 trillion. All right, so if you just do some quick math, that's $1,900 billion times 2.2%. That's $41.8 billion of just interest payments right now if they kept rates steady. And so you can see that's a huge annual transfer to the commercial banks. And they're going to actually be increasing rates, right? That's what Powell's saying. He's going to keep increasing. So the point is, you know, where's that money come from? Well, it's coming from the interest earnings of the Fed off of its own assets, the stuff that it bought, the mortgage-backed securities and treasuries that the Fed bought during the rounds of QE. So again, besides all this other stuff going on, I just want to keep emphasizing that point. Among the other things that happened is, amidst the crisis of the fall of 2008, when everyone thought the world was ending, the Fed started paying these side interest payments to banks, something that they never would have been able to justify in normal times, such that right now the Fed is the Fed created a bunch of money out of thin air electronically, bought a bunch of government debt and mortgage-backed securities, what at the time were called toxic assets. Then on the interest earnings from that is shoveling right now about $42 billion in an annual rate to the banks. So, you know, if that's something, you know, if Congress just wanted to vote on that and say, oh, why don't we send $42 billion this year just as a gift to bankers, people would be flipping cars and setting stuff on fire. But since the Fed's doing it, it's such a convoluted thing and people can barely understand it, it's not a big deal. But beyond the unfairness of it, just to make sure people understand the heist that's going on, if you want to use that language, I'm saying they can't keep doing that. The more they raise interest rates, eventually the Fed, you know, that's less money income that the Fed has to then remit to the Treasury. So in a sense, that's like the taxpayers are paying that. But also at some point, it's going to flip. Like what happens if the Fed owes more interest income to the banks than the Fed is earning itself on its own assets? It can't do that. And so that's why I think as they're raising interest rates, the Fed has to be selling off assets, because that when the Fed sells assets off, that destroys reserves. So that means there's a lower base amount that's getting multiplied by whatever the current interest rate is. So lots of things going on, but the big picture is things are moving against the Fed now. They can't just continue those policies that have been in place since the crisis. They have to start returning to normal. And as we've been saying, standard Austrian business cycle theory says when the Fed pushes interest rates artificially low, that blows up an unsustainable boom. And then when they start tightening, that's when the crash occurs.
Yeah, and I'd like to point out, Bob, that because I heard you say several things there. First of all, the enormous contortions that have come about, you know, since the 2008 financial crisis and what the Fed does with commercial banks now is really unbelievable. But, you know, in 1980, the CPI inflation, you know, reached almost 15%, which is very, very high. And the chairman at that time, which was Chairman Paul Volcker, I mean, he acted very, very quickly to try to, you know, keep inflation from just spiraling out of control. And he increased interest rates right away. And he did it. I mean, he really shocked the nation. And I remember it well. And at one point, I know people have heard me say this before, the interest rate shot up to 21.5%. So he had to do that in order to rein in inflation. And it came back down to that normal level you keep speaking about, the 2 and 3%, which is where we are now and what the Fed keeps saying, you know, inflation is still at a normal level, so we can keep increasing the interest rates. And I just want to point out that the CPI doesn't have those major categories that I was speaking about earlier. For example, it doesn't include any of the investment type items like the stock market or the real estate market or bonds or mutual funds. Life insurance. It doesn't include any of those prices. And this is what I'm getting at, is that those are the assets that have been greatly inflated during this period of time. Not necessarily the basket of goods that are in the CPI. It's these particular assets that were purposely inflated to the levels that they are now. And of course, when they start to come down, it's going to create problems within the whole economy. And it's bringing it down, you know, gently without panicking people is where I think the real problem is. But going back to what Bernanke said, Bernanke was deliberately trying to inflate these specific assets, the assets that are not included in the CPI. And he was doing it for purposes of trying to make everybody feel prosperous and wealthy, even though the nation was in no such position. There for a while, we were reading that, you know, business was doing great, but they weren't. Business was anemic. Some of these big corporations were having very bad years. They were using the low interest rate environment to issue their own bonds, and they were using those bonds to repurchase some of their own shares of stock, which would make their company, their financials, look stronger in a weak economic period. So many companies began to do that. They started using that low interest rate to issue their own corporate bonds, and then they would use that cash to buy back their own shares. And many companies have done that. Now, other companies issued their own bonds because of the low interest rate environments, and they took that money and started buying out their competitors. But so many of those companies have overextended themselves, have over-leveraged themselves to the point that in a way they've created what can be classified as a huge junk market right now for bonds. And so if these classes, asset classes, start to come down too fast, you know, it can hurt a lot of companies, and a lot of these companies that have over-leveraged themselves using that low interest rate environment.
Yeah, just to give an example on that, I don't know if you've been following this, Craig, but I was just reading an article yesterday. My brother used to work at GE, so I'm interested. And they're in big trouble now that they're carrying $114 billion in debt, just the company GE. and that's something like 3.7 times their equity. You know, so that's a pretty big leverage factor. And I think they're BBB, and they're, you know, people are worried that they're going to get downgraded again. So, I mean, it really is, as Jeff Dice said, that was another interview on the Bob Murphy Show that I did recently, where he was saying he thinks that these low interest rate environments, they just lead corporate leaders into making really short-sighted, foolish decisions Because again, if you're in a bubble mentality where your competitors are getting ahead, you don't want to be left behind. You don't want to be the conservative stick in the mud. And when interest rates are at rock bottom levels, it seems really easy to expand, and then you just don't get overextended. I mean, it's obvious in retrospect, but I mean, look at all the stupid stuff that happened during the housing bubble years. And yet for some reason, people at that time thought they were being really savvy and sophisticated, and the people saying, hey, this can't last, they were literally laughed at.
Yeah, we always have to keep in mind that assets support loans. So the more inflated the assets assets are, the bigger the loans. But, you know, what happens when these assets decline or come crashing down? You know, what about the people holding the loans, you know, out there? It creates a major problem. And I think that those lenders, you know, that have lent money on those inflated assets, if those assets come crashing down, I mean, they're going to start scurrying and running around trying to protect their assets, seizing assets as much as they can. So I keep stressing that this new chair, Powell, he probably realizes, you know, what a scary situation he's got to maneuver and manage. Because he realizes, you know, he's got to increase those interest rates. He's got to bring down those inflated assets down to normal levels too. But whether he can get away without panicking the public is another thing.
Yeah, so I guess we can start wrapping up here, and we've sort of given our general overview. So I guess as far as closing thoughts, one thing is, if you haven't yet seen the video Carlson and I did on how to weather the coming financial storms, you definitely want to check that out. You can, it's at the main, you know, LaraMurphy.com. It's featured prominently right there if you go in the near future there. Also, I'll put a direct link in the show notes page. So again, right now you're listening to episode 64 of our podcast if you want to look it up that way. We also have the second edition of our book with Nelson Nash is available now. I'm not sure if we've mentioned that here on the podcast. And so for that, go to thecaseforibc.com to get more information about the book and how to order it. And I guess just big picture, I would say that if the crash comes like we're saying, it's not going to be that the head of Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek pop out of the stock market charts. I mean, there's always going to be specific reasons. It's going to be, oh yeah, GE's overextended because of such and such, and they acquired this thing and they shouldn't have, and they made this bond issue and they should. And, you know, there are particular mistakes that are made. What the Austrian theory helps you understand is, in what environments are people more likely to make clusters of errors? Like, why does it seem to be, for example, in 2007, a bunch of people realized, wow, we made a bunch of dumb decisions over the last 5 years? Like, it's not just an evenly distributed set of mistakes, which, you know, in any large economy, of course, lots of entrepreneurs are going to be making forecast errors all the time. But the point is, why do they seem to come in clusters? And in the Austrian paradigm, it's because artificially low interest rates give the wrong signal. Or putting it a different way, the interest rate is a price. It has a job to do. And so if it's the wrong price, then it's going to do the wrong thing. And so in the Austrian framework, the wrong thing is, when it's artificially low, it fosters malinvestments, as Carlos was saying. And so, yes, you as a savvy investor, you know, you can pick and choose and you can try to, you know, be more specific. But the point is that when you flood the markets with cheap money, a lot of bad investments are going to be made. And then when that's really going to manifest itself is when the spigot gets turned off and interest rates rise. That's when the chickens come home to roost. Any final words of wisdom for our listeners, Carlos?
Well, we have some interesting times to look forward to. I still see the stock market continue to react wildly like this. And like I said, I'm hoping that that everyone at least takes time to watch that video that we put together, because I think it gives everybody a pretty good balanced strategy on how to deal with what we feel is coming our way pretty soon. So we need to be prepared.
Yes, that's a good point, that in case it wasn't clear, the video is called How to Weather the Coming Financial Storm. So we don't just merely have gloom and doom. We give very tangible, specific things that you can do as a household or a small business owner to protect yourself as much as possible from these coming dislocations, as they say. Well, that's all of the time we have for this episode. Again, we're recording here episode 64 of the Laura Murphy Show, if you want to look that up. And we'll see y'all next time.
You've just finished another episode of the Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.